This man's the definition of a working actor, but he's much more than that. We're going to talk to John Marshall Jones next.
You are tuned in to Black Hollywood Live. Conversations.
That's right. Hey, I like break it down. Little chair dance. Hey. That's right.
Which is what you do when you get fully grown.
That's right. Just chair, you dance in the chair. Work it out. Hello, you guys. We're welcome to Black Hollywood Live's Conversations here on blackhollywoodlive.com. We're doing a little soul-to-soul, back-to-life, back-to-reality, and there's a lot of reality going on, so we're going to talk about that later. Hi, I'm James Lott Jr. I'm your host of this episode. I'm excited to be here today. You can follow me at James Lott Jr. all over the interwebs. Yeah, I said interwebs. I did. And my guest today, I mean seriously, when I was looking up his credits, it went on for about 5 or 6 pages. He's been in everything. Just about everything. Think about it. Just about everything. I'm going to go ahead and name just like 1/100th of what he's been in that many of you guys always talk about when I mention he's going to be on my show. Smart Guy, The Truth, Criminal Minds, China Beach, which I loved, Pretty Little Liars, In the Cut. That's just like 6 or 7 things he's done out of 1,000. He's also the creator of the Mastering the Audition, and he has a movie coming out called The Last Revolutionary. I'm so excited to have him here today. He's a great guy, John Marshall Jones.
Thank you, James. Thank you.
Welcome. Now, we're going to start off because I actually have met Taj Mahri. He was on my show. I do the Baby Daddy after show, and he's on Baby Daddy. He plays Tucker, and what a great young man, first of all.
Yeah.
Talked to him before and after. Just delightful, great guy. Good head on his shoulders. And because you're here, and a lot of people, when I mention you're coming on, of that age group, like, oh my God, it's the dad from Smart. So we're going to show a clip of you and Taj back in the day.
Okay. Looks like I'm mastering the audition.
Well, not that one. The other one.
May I have a moment, please?
Oh, my God. Was it 2 of the same link? No, they're different. They're different. Oh, live television. I love it. What's your other? But meanwhile, while we're getting waiting for that, I was going to ask you, how was it with that? That show was a hit, and it was early on in the TV of the 90s.
Well, here was the interesting. It was an interesting time because there was a new model for how television would work, which was that a syndicator would purchase programming time in multiple markets on individual syndicated stations.
Yeah.
So Fox began with that, and the way to reach the audience in urban markets was, of course, to do black shows. Mm-hmm. So Fox did a series of black shows until they built up enough of an audience to go mainstream, and then they kicked the black folks out.
Yeah.
And then WB and UPN,
that's right.
Together they merged and become CW.
Yes.
But WB and UPN each had their own sort of black network kind of thing going on. So we recognized at the time that there was a window for getting in, doing a black show before they got enough of an audience to go mainstream and kicked us out.
Got it.
So so it was a special time because we were on, Steve Harvey was on,
so
Jamie Foxx was on, the Wayans were on.
Yes.
We were all kind of on one black night.
Right.
And it was a special, exciting time in Black Hollywood because all of those shows, in their own way, portrayed black people in a positive light.
Yes.
You know, it's not, now we have Love and Hip Hop Hollywood, yes, you know, which is what young people are looking at to see what they're supposed to aspire to.
Yes.
But during that time, it was much more traditional and traditional African-American values that were reflected in the shows that were on the air. And then a strange thing happened in that WB, for a number of reasons, none of which were the quality of the show or the ratings of the show, decided to cancel the show. Mm. Disney was the producing studio, which also had Disney Channel.
Yes.
So rather than telling the audience that the show's been canceled, they just canceled it quietly and moved it to the Disney Channel.
Ah. Okay.
So most people at that time didn't even realize the show had been canceled. They only knew that now it was coming on Disney Channel.
Okay, got it.
Disney goes to over 170 countries across the globe.
Wow.
And so Smart Guy became their number one hit for 2 years running. It became a worldwide hit. And it took that image of an African-American genius and also the image of a stable African-American father figure around which, around a loving African-American family. And it took that to 170 countries worldwide. And so people who never had a chance to interact with African-Americans or who only saw African-Americans through music videos now had a balancing influence in the images that were projected to them. So that's something that that to this day I'm very, very proud of. And I'm very, very proud of Taj. And his parents were very, very involved in making sure that he didn't become one of those Hollywood kids. His father had him out there playing football, which, of course, he ended up going to college on a scholarship.
Yeah.
But when I saw him, he was a little 10, 11-year-old boy playing with 12 and 13-year-olds.
Yeah.
And I saw them try to twist his head off one day. And I was like, yo, hey, hey, look, hey, Pops, I need to talk to you. Because I'm trying to pay for stuff. And we can't have Smart Guy get his head twisted off. I was genuinely alarmed at this whole situation. But it ended up that it was really good for him and comes from a great family. And
yeah, the sisters and all, they're all good. They're all
good. They're all
I like that.
Marvelously unaffected.
That's what it seems like,
by the affectations of Hollywood.
Yeah. I mean, Taj was like, he was just like a regular guy.
Yeah, he's a regular guy.
He was so, oh my God, he was so friendly and warm. You're right, because back then, you know, we also had the wonderful, one of my idols, Robert Townsend, had Parenthood. I mean, which time we had people who had, oh, what happened? Where all the black shows go? Like, I mean, the 90s, we had a ton of them. Not even just WB and UPN, we had My Wife and Kids and Bernie Mac. We had all these shows that were like showing black families.
The Window Closed.
Moesha, all that.
Yeah. The Window Closed. It'll open again.
It's starting to now, I guess.
Yeah, everything is cyclical.
That's true.
And what'll happen is we're going to have a black show come on that becomes a phenomenon.
Okay.
And then you'll have 100 networks rush in to copy it.
That's true, yes.
And so during those times where you're at a lower lull is where you have to really become creative about, as an artist, about how you're going to, number one, survive economically.
Yes.
Number two, continue to stay relevant. And number three, continue to work on your art.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge, but, you know, as you see by myself and many other African-American actors that are my age that I've known in the business for 20, 30 years, that part of the business that is so important is your willingness and determination to develop longevity, which means you might not be the biggest star in Hollywood, but you can continue to work and make a living and be impactful as long as you can wrap your head around what's going on around you at that particular time.
And do you have to be okay with giving up that, or do you give up that dream that you'll be, if you want that big known stuff, do you have to give that up on some level, or do you always kind of have it, like it can still happen anytime? Or
I think that the important thing to understand is that that big known thing is, you know, the biggest star in Hollywood, the Will Smith, the Eddie Murphy, that is something that is created by Hollywood to sell their product, and it's not the only thing that's going on.
Right.
And what happens is most people get caught up into thinking they have to have that job.
Yes.
And that nothing else will suffice.
Right.
So for me, I had my 50th birthday.
Okay.
And now I live in a, you know, not the biggest house in Hollywood, but, you know, I live on a hill with a view of the ocean and, you know, hot tub in the backyard and, you know, the whole, you know, kind of black Hollywood thing, right? Yes. I've got it going on.
Yes.
But I wasn't enjoying it because I was thinking that I should be doing more.
Oh, okay.
And I walked into my backyard one day and I said, wow, JJ, so if this is as good as it gets,
okay,
how'd you do? And I looked around.
You did good.
And I was like, shit, you did great. You did great, and you're about to miss it, thinking that you should have done better.
Yes.
And that's when my life, mind, spirit changed, because I was able to accept that where I am is exactly where I'm supposed to be. And the moment that I accepted that, I accepted the idea of plenty rather than accepting the idea of lack. Same exact stuff.
You're speaking it, right? Yes, yes.
Same stuff. The stuff didn't change.
Right.
My attitude about it changed.
Yeah.
What I didn't realize is that when my attitude about that changed, it's not just about that. The attitude affects everything in your life. Mm-hmm. So when I accepted the plenty that I was, then all kinds of plenty started coming, because now I was thinking in terms of accepting abundance rather than accepting lack and what I don't have. Same stuff, different attitude. Changed my life.
God, that's beautiful. It's funny because I know for me, and this is just my thing with this, is that I have a garden. I have a huge backyard. And I live in South LA, and I was this huge backyard. It was just like, I remember one day I was just staring at it. I was like, you know, I own my home, and I'm just staring at this yard. And then I was like, I got this idea. I want a garden. So I bought a few plants first, and I bought a sweet potato plant. I did all this, just little by little. And then after about 6-7 months of doing this, and I started seeing stuff grow, literally seeing it grow, like I said off camera, it calmed me down.
Mm-hmm.
When you have to plant something and tend to it, it's like, ooh, it really does teach you a lot about yourself.
Ooh.
And that's what changed my life. I have a garden. And all my fans know, they always post pictures, and I have some bougainvillea growing over here and tangerines there. And but I'm so proud of it because it did give me back something that I didn't have when I was younger. It was like, naturally, when my grandmother had a garden, she was from Louisiana, and I see why she had a garden. She was always out there every other day.
Mm-hmm.
Picking the weeds and getting the figs off the tree. It's like, and why she was always so happy to do it and then cook it and then have food I make with my stuff.
Right.
But starting that little seedling of starting to plant something and actually tend to it, make sure it's okay, make sure the water's happening, the soil, the sun's okay, it really does calm you down and see things, everything else differently.
Well, one of the things that it does is it takes the focus off of you. And all of those, we have 60 to 80,000 thoughts that go through our head.
I believe it.
Every day.
I believe it.
And the ability to calm that process is where peace of mind comes from. Your mind is constantly in a storm. And nobody teaches us how to not be in a storm.
No.
So things like that, things like gardening and having to actually put a seed in the ground and pour water on it, and nothing's happening. So you have to develop patience.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, yes, yes.
You have to develop an attention to detail, because the weeds will come up and overtake your garden, and it can happen in 7 days. Mm-hmm. You leave your garden alone for 7 days, mm-hmm. you come back out, the weeds are all over. Mm-hmm. And that's how our minds and our attitudes are.
Yes.
So if we accept an attitude, let's say you're working on a set and something happens and you accept an attitude of resentment, and you don't pull that weed out of your mind, you let it grow for a week or two, next thing you do is blow up at somebody. Now, they're not affected by that, right?
Right.
You blew up at them. The chemical, the emotions that had to build up in your body in order for you to get that kind of energy to blow up at somebody, they're still in your body. They're not in theirs.
That's true.
And they'll walk away from this and may not even remember what happened. If you talk to them 4 or 5 years later, say, really?
Yeah.
But you have the chemicals of resentment in your body that now have become an attitude. So every time you think about it, you can recreate those chemicals. Mm-hmm. Those chemicals are poison, and they're killing us.
They are.
And so it is very, very important. The idea of forgiveness is not weakness. It is understanding what your longevity is really all about. And that is not holding on to things that are past, P-A-S-S-E-D. They are past. They don't exist anymore. And so you don't give them any energy. You forgive, which means to let those things go and focus on the moment at hand.
Well, I'll tell you, I learned this on Oprah years ago. It changed my life. It clicked when she said that forgiveness is giving up the hope the past could be any different.
Yes. Yes.
Once I heard that, it changed everything. My relationships, my work, everything. I was like, oh, that makes sense, because what has happened already happened. You really can't do... No, even if somebody says, I'm sorry that I did this to you 10 years ago, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
It's already done. It's already happened. You just need to forgive anyway. And forgiveness is for yourself anyway, not for another person in the first place. It's for you.
It's for you.
That was a hard concept to grasp at first, though. Like, what does that mean? It's for me. Like, I'm like, what do you mean? What is that? And then I got it. I was like, oh, now I get it, because it's inside of me. I can create cancer in there if I don't forgive myself or my parts in anything. It hit me. Something hit me.
There you go.
Got it. Now we're going to switch gears just for a second. I can talk to you forever right now about this stuff, but just for a second, now we have the clip up, so we're going to show the clip of you guys together. We're going to continue this whole conversation.
Wow, it's our house.
It's your house, so go ahead and show it.
Oh my goodness.
Who knows about science? Miss Krupp just used to pick food out of her teeth, stare at the clock, and mumble about tenure.
Holy, Mr. Harrison sounds like a terrific teacher.
He is. He even arranged for us to go to the planetarium and look through the Zeiss Refracting Telescope this Saturday.
But we're going camping Saturday.
Oh, I completely forgot.
You forgot?
Oh, I want to go camping. I really do. The last thing I want to do is hurt your feelings. It's just an incredible opportunity.
Oh, well, I understand. You know, when those opportunities come up, you just got to grab them. So that means I got to miss out on dragging my butt up Hogback Mountain, sleeping on a half-inflated air mattress, and going to the bathroom in front of a deer. So be it.
Thanks, Dad.
So I want to say, it's just, I mean, and I, now I'm having a full circle moment, because now I'm sitting here next to you. I sat with him. He still looks like he's 12 years old in real life today, but he's like, I have a mustache now. So you have a mustache. Oh, my God. But when you look at stuff like that, because you're one of the few dads that was on TV that wasn't the bumbling dad. It wasn't the, you know, like, oh, my God, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm kind of hapless, but I still send a message. You were like a strong African-American, I want to get it out, African-American father on television.
That was on purpose.
Okay.
And the writers of Smart Guy, Danny Kalis and Bob Young, were both fathers. They were very open to my concerns.
Oh, good. Okay.
Most of the scripts came back without the dad being, you know, a bumbling fool.
Good.
But periodically, one would come in, and I would go back, and I would have a sit-down with him. And this is very important in how you deal with people that are your bosses or have more status than you do. Because for you young people out there, the thing you don't want to do is make them have to show you that their status is higher than yours.
Yes.
So the way that I would deal with Bob and Danny was to say, hey, listen, I'd like to talk to you guys. I have some concerns. I would voice my concerns, and then at the end of it would say, but you know what? You guys have put together an incredible show. You've got great judgment. I know you guys will make the right decision. And so thank you for listening. And I'd leave. And 95% of the time, they would just make the change.
I like that.
You know, and it worked out that by voicing my concern and then addressing to them that I understand what the pecking order is here, and whatever you come up with, I'm on your team. But like these are my concerns.
Like that.
Allowed them to then be able to make changes without losing status. And so it was a very collaborative effort in making sure that this African-American father would be somebody that people could look up to. And I'm very proud of that work.
Because, and you should be. I mean, not, no offense to any other show. I liked a lot of the shows that are on TV. And even like Black-ish today, I enjoy Anthony Anderson's performance. I think it's funny. But he does come across sometimes as the hapless kind of father who inadvertently sends a message. or there's a message or something. Where like you, there's another father thing of just a minute ago, but you guys were not that. You're very much just like the straight laced good father who would listen and would, you know, that we didn't see portrayals of on television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that Black-ish, which I really enjoy as a show,
me too,
is moving more toward today's style of comedy.
Yeah.
So the single camera style of comedy has a little more to do with the lead character dealing with a bit of humiliation.
Yes.
And if you look at Modern Family, if you look at the hit shows now, the lead character deals with a bit of self-deprecation, mm-hmm. a bit of humiliation, but then learns his way through to the end.
Mm-hmm.
So the style of comedy has changed because the technology of it has changed, mm-hmm. and they needed to deliver comedy in a way that makes it fresh and updated, rather than looking like, you know, you're still making the same thing from 1990.
Yeah.
Because with the advent of cable, satellite, and internet, you better have something fresh on, or people are, you know, they're gone.
God, nowadays you got Netflix, Hulu, PlayStation has series. I mean, like, not Amazon has series. I mean,
you think about how long you'll stay on a station if it doesn't interest you. It's really about 5 seconds.
Yeah, that's true.
Because there's another thing right away, and now there's an iPad sitting right next to you that you can pick up and start scrolling through. And, you know, like you said, Netflix, Hulu, or you have the TV has internet on
it. Yes, they do, yeah.
So you just hit another button, and now you're at Netflix, Hulu, YouTube, and you can find whatever it is that interests you by typing in the title.
Mm-hmm.
So television, network television, has to be fresh all the time, or they lose their audience.
Yeah, that's very true. Now, speaking of television and everything, I'm going to ask you, I'll call this speed round, for folks who have credits that go longer than my arm.
Oh, God, don't ask me nothing I don't remember.
Yeah, well, if you don't remember, just say you don't remember. That's what I told a guy I interviewed yesterday. He had, like you, all these credits. So you don't remember it, or just kind of, that's fine. But I'm not going to ask too many, but just a few. Bosch.
Loved it.
Titus Williver. Tell me about him a little bit.
Titus is an actor's actor. He is not intimidated by anybody or anything, and he'll stand right in the middle of the storm and express his character.
Wow.
Which means that you, standing across from him, can fully express what you're trying to do.
Okay.
Because Titus is not going to be afraid of how he looks while you're doing it. It's a very, very rare thing.
Wow. I love him as an actor. I can only imagine. Okay, now some of these things you did, these were small roles, but I see if you have any kind of remembrance of any of them. Good Morning Vietnam.
Loved it. My first movie.
Your first movie?
Yeah, well, my first movie was a movie called Tapeheads.
That sounds familiar, actually.
Yeah, it was with John Cusack and Tim Robbins.
Okay, Tom Cusack, okay.
Little independent film, really, really funny. And I was getting ready to go back to Chicago.
Okay.
I come from Chicago to do
love
that.
Chicago.
I was going to go back to Chicago, go back to my job after doing this movie of working in a telephone sales boiler room.
Oh, you were...
because I had spent all the money that I made on tape heads.
I love it.
Hanging
love
out. Because that's what you do when you're 23. You spend that money.
Yes, you do. That's right.
And before I could get out of L.A., my agent called me and told me, hey, you got another movie. It's Good Morning Vietnam. You're leaving for Bangkok tomorrow.
Dang.
And it was for 3 months.
Wow.
And what an experience. Robin Williams was...
Oh, may he rest in peace.
May he rest in peace was such an extraordinary and giving person, as well as actor. But there was a day that I'll never forget. That were we had all these extras in full gear and rucksacks. And it was 110 degrees or something like that. And they had to march up this runway about 100 yards and go back. And they were going back and forth. And we were marching at the beginning of the scene. And then we would go off camera. And I would run right over and, you know, find an umbrella. Because they didn't have air conditioning, but you could at least stand in the shade.
Yeah, oh, yeah, sure.
And I was complaining about how hot it was.
Okay.
And then I looked over and Robin was entertaining the Thai extras in this sort of, you know, without language. He was entertaining them and making them laugh when they didn't speak English.
Wow.
And he stood out there all day, not all day, but for as long as it took. So maybe 90 minutes, 2 hours, something like that. And he kept entertaining them and kept them fresh the whole time.
Wow.
And I went from feeling like, oh, well, I'm a movie actor now, to feeling that big, watching the star of the movie do that.
Wow.
And it taught me that the bigger that you get in this business, the more humble you need to become.
Mm.
And that all of those people that are working in the smallest jobs are the ones that make your movie great. So you have to acknowledge that and take care of those people on any set you're on, because those little things are the difference between a good project and a great project.
Wow.
And I learned that from Robin
Williams. That's amazing. White Man Can't Jump.
Man, that was an awesome film. So that was Wesley Snipes and Woody
Harrelson.
Yes, Woody
Harrelson. I remember seeing the theater.
So the scene that we shot, the sequence that I was in, was playing basketball at Venice Beach.
I love it.
I lived in a apartment in Santa Monica right on the beach.
Okay, right there.
So I could get up in the morning, ride down the bike path.
Yes, that bike path, yes.
Go and play basketball. Oh my God. That part lasted for about 3 days, although it took about 10 days to do the scene.
Okay.
At the point where I leave, there was this beautiful young lady named Sarah Stavrou.
Okay.
And Sarah was fine. And Sarah was playing my girlfriend.
Okay.
And so when I left the court, I went over and laid down on her lap. I laid my head on her lap.
Okay.
And because of the way it was shot, we had to do that for 7 days.
Oh.
So I spent 7 days.
Okay.
Getting paid.
Getting paid. Don't forget
to lay
paid.
My head in this beautiful young lady's lap. One of the best jobs I ever had.
Talk about gratitude. You can't complain. How are you going to complain?
Yeah, no, it was.
Like, hello.
It was awesome.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. That's a great story. Con Air.
Con Air. Terrific piece.
Great movie. I love that movie.
Terrific piece. They hired me to come out for a month to Utah to fly this helicopter.
Yes.
And, you know, we're supposed to be, John Cusack was in the helicopter with me, who's an old friend of mine. And we're supposed to fly around and chase Con Air.
Yes.
But the director was going over budget.
Right.
They were over budget by $20 million.
Oh, my God.
So they said, well, where can we make up this $20 million at? We'll start with you. And so they broke my deal and decided to shoot it in front of a green screen for a day.
Oh, dang.
But they ended up paying me for a couple of weeks.
Okay,
so
that was okay.
So I took a couple of weeks, but I was like, yo, you $20 million over budget, and you starting with me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's that about?
Yeah, why are you starting with me?
What did I do?
I ain't making $20 million.
I love that. Frank's Place. Tim Reed.
Awesome. Awesome piece. That was my my first television show. And I came out here, created this character named Gregory Duleen, big country boy.
Yes.
And I did one episode, and I went over to the executive producer. Forget his last name. His first name was Hugh.
Yeah.
And I said, Hugh, I'm fresh off the boat from Chicago. I don't know anything about television. Would it be okay with you if I just came and watched?
Oh, wow.
And he said, yes.
Okay.
And so for probably about a month, 6 weeks or so, I just came to the set and watched what was going on.
Wow.
And learned so much.
Smart.
You know, just watching. And some people were okay with it. Some of the actors were like, hey, what are you doing here?
Yeah, sure.
Like, you trying to take my job. But there were people on the crew, though, that came over and really schooled me on how things work.
Wow.
And there was a veteran actor named Lincoln Kilpatrick. And I went over to Lincoln one day. I said, Mr. Kilpatrick, listen, I'm a fan of yours as well. I just want to know, I'm fresh here. Is there any piece of wisdom that you could share with me? And he said, yeah, everything going to be all right as soon as you learn how to get out your own way. And
that's so smart. That's smart.
And it went.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, huh?
Right.
And about 20 years later,
yeah.
I was sitting in a diner and went, oh, damn, that's what he was talking about. I could have learned this 20 years ago. Why didn't he just say? It's like, yeah, he did. You just didn't have enough going on yet to understand this diamond that he handed
you.
He has it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, good, really like good that. Experience.
That. And my show that I cried to every episode, China Beach. Incredible cast. I mean, the cast of that show, everyone was amazing.
Yeah. Terrific cast. Dana Delaney is just a heartbreaker, that beautiful eyes and beautiful smile and just as sweet as she could be. China Beach was a show where I learned something about Hollywood.
Okay.
So
tell us.
I did this character, Fluke Johnson.
Yes.
And Fluke was the guy that could get you stuff.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So German beer, Japanese hose.
I remember, all at a wholesale
price. Okay. So they liked the character enough to bring him back.
Yeah, I remember. You were
listen, okay.
Yeah.
So I come back and they say, okay, so listen, just so you know, you know, Fluke's going to get killed in this episode. We didn't want to make a big deal out of it. And I said, okay, no problem. So I go on, I do the episode, and we don't have my death scene.
No.
And I was like, oh, that's weird. Okay. So I go home, the episode comes on. Now, mind you, I had been teaching, which I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit later.
Yeah.
And teaching my students how you have to have integrity around your work and, you know, you make sure that the images that you put out there are valuable images for the African-American community and blah, 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 blah. So the episode comes on.
Yes.
And Fluke Johnson has gotten killed by the KKK element in the racial tension episode, and they found his body burned to a crisp on top of a cross. And I was like, wow. They got me.
Yeah.
They got me. And I never saw, it was John Socrate Young was the executive producer.
Yeah.
I never saw him again.
I love it.
And I was like, wow. Because I was going to tell him about it.
I'm sure.
Because I didn't, I don't care. But yeah, they got me. So I learned something.
And
what you learn is that you do your best, but you're not in control of everything.
Yes.
So you do your best to put out the best images that you can to stay within your own sense of integrity.
Yeah.
But some things you are not in control of, and you got to keep it moving.
Yeah.
Because Hollywood is about longevity.
It is.
And that TV show that you think is so important is entertainment for the moment.
Yep.
And next week there's another episode, and nobody remembers what you did.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
They only remember if you're on every week.
Right.
Then they don't remember all the episodes, they just remember you.
Mm-hmm.
So that thing that I thought was so devastating, it was gone in a week, and nobody remembered.
Makes sense. That makes sense.
But I still remember.
He's not going to forget, folks. He ain't going to forget. He forgets. I love it. You also did an episode of Roseanne.
I did do Roseanne.
My girl Roseanne. What comes to mind about that? What comes to mind?
It was Tom Arnold's first episode.
Oh, when he came on. Okay, yes.
Yeah. And Tom Arnold was going through his addiction with cocaine.
Wow.
And so he was on the set. It was a cold, because TV sets are, they keep them really cold.
Yeah.
They're like refrigerated.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And he was bright red and sweating like a pig.
Dang.
And Roseanne had to clear the set a couple times because Tom wasn't performing and people were starting to talk out loud.
Yes.
Right? So the day came for the shoot and Tom could not put together more than two lines at a time.
Dang.
So they had to do a line and then cut and then do a line and then cut.
Oh my God.
And then do a line and then cut. And then do a line and then cut.
God bless America. Okay.
When the show came on, he looked great.
No, he did. I remember that episode now.
He looked fine. And I realized from that point, they can make anybody look good if they're committed to doing it.
Mm.
And later on, you know, Tom got over his addiction.
Yeah, great actor.
You know, moved through, became kind of a well-known character actor, and then hosted his own television show and became very, very wealthy. Yeah. So, you know, so if you are determined enough, you know, then the opportunity can come to you.
Yeah, that's true.
And if you're willing to sleep with Roseanne Barr.
Okay. I mean, you should get a TV show or something out of that one. You should get wealthy out of that one too. I'm coming. I love some Roseanne, but I'm like, okay. Some quick words because I want to get to your next thing. Some quick words. You've done so many things. You did Melrose Place.
Yeah, that was good.
Different World.
That was a good one. Yes.
ER, did an episode.
Did that was George Clooney before everybody knew he was George Clooney.
And you did a couple of shows that I really liked. That lasted a little bit of time, but not too much. Any Day Now.
Oh, yeah. It was an excellent show.
I love that show. Providence.
Yeah. Another show I love. Wow, you're going back.
I am. John Doe, which is a show that I liked and didn't make it. I love John Doe. I did not make it.
John Doe got caught between the network and the executive producers.
Oh, really? Okay.
X-Files was the hit of the time, and we followed X-Files.
Yes, I remember that.
The producers wanted to do another X-Files. The network had already moved on and wanted us to do CSI.
Okay.
And the tone of those shows is very different.
Yeah, yeah.
X-Files was very dark and mysterious.
Yes,
CSI is brighter and more technical.
Mm-hmm.
And they just battled and battled and battled and never could come to it and finally just canceled us. Then they took our sets and our music, and they hired for a new show a guy named David Boreanaz, and they made a show called Bones.
Bones, still on, yes.
Which is, when you look at it, it is a forensic CSI kind of show.
Oh, how funny, yes.
That is built around what the network wanted to do.
Yeah.
But they had, you know, the concept of the little computer guys back in the room. They took our computer set.
Wow, funny.
They took some of the music that we used.
Yeah.
And they made the show Bones.
I didn't know that.
And I remember one day, soon after we had been canceled, that I heard some music on television. I was like, oh, that's our show. I saw we back on, thinking we're in reruns or something, right? And I came over and looked, and it was Bones, and it was the same construction.
That's hilarious.
I was like, oh, okay, we ain't gonna make no money.
Okay, you're all Hollywood. you did an episode of Nip Tuck, which I used to love that show.
Yep.
NCIS.
Yes.
Still Standing.
Yes.
Joan of Arcadia, which I loved that show too. That was another good show that I loved so much. Mary Steenburgen, Jason Ritter, Amber Tamblyn. I mean, like,
they had multiple kinds of people playing expressions of God.
Yes, which I love that concept.
Yeah,
love that concept.
It was fabulous. And I did a movie that Amber.
You played God twice.
I played God. I was actually on three episodes.
Okay, didn't tell you. Okay. Yeah. You were on there several times, I remember.
But I did a movie last year that's coming out sometime this year called Paint It Black.
Okay.
Which was directed by Amber Tamblyn.
Oh, okay. Okay,
so
good.
She's directing now.
Oh, good.
Has kind of moved on to that next kind of level of her career.
Well, she comes from a father who was famous actor, and then she was also on General Hospital. I mean, she's been around for a long time.
Yeah.
Good stuff. But there's more things you can look up his life. There's just more stuff going on. I mean, Pretty Little Liars, Boston Legal. I mean, just everything. Just lots of work. It's very inspiring to see someone who just continually works and plays these different characters and gets to be an actor.
Well, one of the things that you learn over time is that there's a difference between being a celebrity and being an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and you're kind of conditioned to think that if you're not a celebrity, then your career was a failure. I have a certain level of celebrity, but what I'm really committed to is the craft of acting. And so sometimes that means you do something impactful, but it's one scene.
Mm-hmm.
But it's impactful to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And can you wrap your ego around the idea that I'm going to do this one impactful scene and keep moving to other projects? Or do you say, well, no, I'm not going to do that. It's only one scene.
Right.
And the difference between a celebrity or a personality and an actor is that an actor makes up his mind that he's going to continue to work, mm-hmm. And some things pay $5 million and some things pay $5.
Right.
But the work is how you define your success.
I like that.
And I had to learn early on that if you accept a definition of success that is defined by someone else, then you also accept that they have the ability to take that away from you. Mm-hmm. And so I had to develop a definition of success for me that could not be taken away.
Got it.
So to me, success is being at the height of my craft every time I step on stage.
I like that.
And making a living at what I do in a creative standpoint without having to do anything else.
That's success. That to me, that's success. That's what I. That's what I'm doing. I mean, I don't want to work at a video store or whatever. Or whatever to do. I mean, I want to be able to do what I do full time.
Yes. Yes.
I like that. We're going to show a clip. It's a perfect segue. We're going to show part of your clip of one of your acting, one of your mastering the audition videos.
May I have a moment, please?
Now, this is one of the most important
points. Love the top. Love the dashiki. Love it.
A lot of times, we feel disempowered in the room, and we want to go in and we want to please everybody. You can't be successful at this. You can't master this trying to please people. You have to be the one to take control of the situation. If they're behind, they're going to start reading, and if their character reads first, you could be looking down at your sheet trying to get yourself together, and they just start reading the scene. And now you're playing catch up. And you never do catch up to the scene. Then it's over. They say, thank you. And all you can think is you walk out of there feeling like, what happened? Well, what happened is you let them take control of the scene instead of you taking control of the scene. And when you take control of the audition, you are always ready when it starts. And there is a very simple process that won't offend anybody. And that is, you get in the room, you said hello, hello to Jim, hello to Bob, how are you? You have a picture and resume, great, are you ready? And your response is, may I have just a moment, please? And then you turn your back. Now, by taking just by, there is no casting director in the world that is going to tell you you can't have a moment to focus. But what you're really doing is you're not taking a moment to focus. You are letting them know that the scene starts when I start. So don't start reading without me. I'm not ready. The most important thing you can do is to seize your moment. Now, these are your 5 minutes. Do not let them start without you. May I have a moment, please? Turn your back. Gather yourself. Now you're ready. Now you're ready to begin your audition.
I love it. That's so it's almost in the same vein of just sometimes when you get into the other situations where you take a moment first.
Yeah.
Take that beat. Take a moment. And then, like, we always tell people, you should watch what you say. Like, take a moment before you say something.
Yes.
Think about it for a second. And then you can speak. Like, a lot of times you'll change what you're about to say.
Right.
Or your attitude can change that. One moment can change that attitude.
Right.
So I love that. Because auditions are, man, they're scary. They're this, they're that. You're hopeful, you're this, all this stuff. And I talked to a lot of actors, and I'll have you talk about this, where they said some people who've been in business for a long time have learned the audition is just like going on a roll. They go in, you do it, and you go about your business. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, one of the things to really understand about the audition process is that it's not acting.
Okay.
Because the other person on the other side isn't really giving you much of anything.
Okay.
It is a competition in which you are called upon to perform at your highest level.
Got it.
So you're coming in to perform the scene. The other person is just reading.
Well, right. Yeah. These are just, yeah.
Right? But what they're reading has bits of information in it that then have to affect you in how you respond.
Yes.
So your preparation has to be not just what your lines are, but what is your response to what that other person is saying, even though they're not going to give you that when you go in there.
Because there's a lot of acting about being present with the other actor, and they're not really, they're just
Yeah, so you can't just go in there and think that they're going to give you what you need to respond. You have to prepare to respond without them giving it to you.
Wow.
Interesting. And prior to, there's actually three parts to the audition. It's from the time you open the door until you start speaking.
Okay.
Right? So they're making all kinds of decisions.
Oh, yeah, okay, yes. They're looking at you. Okay.
First impression, is only you only get one chance to make
that's
a first impression.
That's true. That's very true.
Then there's the audition itself when you're actually reading with somebody. Then when that's over, what you do between the time you finish it and the time you get out of the room is the third stage of the audition. And can you get out of there without leaving, without damaging what you just did?
Oh, wow. I never thought of that before. Okay.
So you could say something before you get out the door that makes them say,
oh, God, it's,
And we've all done it.
Yeah.
You know, you get excited. You had a great audition.
Okay.
Oh, hey, thanks. And all they're trying to find out in an audition situation really is, do I want to spend 6 weeks with this person?
Yes, yes.
And they're really looking at you personally. They might pick somebody who's not as good an actor because they weren't crazy in their audition.
Mm-hmm.
So you're presenting something to them. You're presenting your professionalism. You're presenting your ability to execute the material. You're presenting your ability to listen and make changes on the fly. You're presenting things. So you have to be ready for that presentation.
Yeah.
And the thing that makes that presentation work the best is confidence. Because what they buy is confidence. They will buy your confidence.
Yeah.
Even if you're not the best actor, if you're the most confident person, then that translates to me wanting to be around you. The person who's on the other side of the table is freaking out because they've got all this stuff set up.
Yeah.
Millions of dollars worth of stuff. Yeah. They don't have the actors yet.
Right.
And if they don't get the actors, then all this other stuff can fall apart.
Yeah.
So they're freaking out, hoping that they find that person. And you, being confident, helps them to calm down so that they can say, I've got this guy.
Yeah.
So how do you develop confidence in a pressure-packed, nerve-wracking situation? Yeah. It's through your ritual of preparation. So if you do kind of the same thing every time to prepare, then after a while you get confident that you are prepared.
That's true.
So that when you go in, you're able to be confident, at least in your preparation, and do somewhat what you did at home.
Got it. Makes sense.
And over time, because it's a numbers game, over time, what you start to find is that you start to be more and more comfortable and competent in the room on auditions, so you start getting more and more confident. And at a certain point, it clicks.
It clicks,
yeah.
God, it's so smart. That's so smart. The last thing I'm going to talk about, I can talk to you forever.
So, before we go,
yes,
you can get this information.
Oh, yes. Please tell everybody.
MasteringTheAudition.com.
Yes.
Or you can reach out to me on Facebook, John Marshall Jones, at my John Marshall Jones fan page. And if you have questions about auditioning or would like to get the audio CD, the audio CD is available. Yeah. And the reason why I love this audio CD is that once you put it in your computer, it's yours for life.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I go back and listen to myself.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
And it's like, oh, yeah, that's what I wasn't doing. Oh, yeah. JJ, get back to basics.
Yeah, we need tune-ups every once in a while. I don't know about that.
Yeah, because in my position in Hollywood, I still go in and audition for things.
Right.
And so if that's how it's going to be, if this is as good as it gets, then I'm okay with being as good as I can get every time I walk in the room.
God, seriously, I can listen to you talk all day long.
Oh, well, thank you, sir.
Seriously, you give us good stuff. Because I want to get to the last thing, of course, The Last Revolutionary. Mm. So go ahead and show the picture of that for people at home. It's a project that you are also one of the producers on, aren't you correct? Is that you?
One of the executives.
One of the executive producers. So let's talk about that movie.
The Last Revolutionary is a brilliant, brilliant script. It's written by Levy Lee Simon, multiple award-winning writer, directed by Michael Brewer, an Emmy Award-winning cinematographer. And Levy and I did this play in Los Angeles.
Okay.
It was chosen for the National Black Theater Festival.
Wow.
We went down to the festival and did it and met Michael down there, who said, wow, this would be a great movie. And we came back and started working on the movie. We did a Kickstarter campaign to raise the money.
Okay.
We raised our money April 11th of this year.
Wow.
We went right into pre-production.
Okay.
And every dime of that money went on screen.
Wow.
Every dime of it. Now, here's what's so interesting and why I feel like this is really something touched by God. The story itself is about two former Black Panther type revolutionaries from the 70s.
Okay.
One has become a traditional conservative suburbanite.
Oh, wow, okay.
And is living with the big house and the picket fence and the BMW and the beautiful wife, and he's got all the trappings.
Yeah.
The other is still in the same apartment he was in 1972, and it's filled with weapons, and he's peeking out the windows waiting for the revolution to start.
Oh, how interesting.
So he has called his old revolutionary group and said, hey, it's Situation Hyena. It's time for us to get down. But one of them is a producer at NBC. And another one is a professor at NYU. And so they call me.
Okay.
They say, hey, did you get a call from Mac? You know, he sound like he getting ready to start some stuff up. So he, well, he don't listen to us.
Yeah.
So maybe you ought to go talk to him.
Wow.
So I fly back from New York.
Yeah.
To come and find him at the stronghold. Still with the headband on, the camouflage headband, the black flak jacket.
Oh, yeah.
Walking around with a Glock in the apartment, peeking out the windows. Except for that, everything that he thinks that we said was wrong in 1972, and that we said we took an oath we would get back together when it got to this point, it's all happening.
Yes, it is.
So I'm trying to talk him out of it by saying, you know, that, hey, you don't really expect us to do this, right?
Right.
And he's looking at me like, what happened to you?
Yeah, you're crazy. Like, you're the one who's crazy.
Yeah, what happened to you? Isn't this and this and this and this going on? Haven't you seen that on the news? Aren't they attacking our president? Aren't they calling his wife by animal names? Aren't they doing this? Isn't that what's happening? Well, yeah, well, then what happened to you?
Yeah.
And so the film becomes an indictment of our black middle class acceptance versus the knowledge in our hearts that things aren't right.
Yeah.
And those two have to come to a meeting of the minds within this confine of this stronghold that also is filled with weapons.
Oh my God.
So it's a high energy, high tension, high intelligence piece between two very, very strong characters who are committed to the moment that they're living in. And fascinating piece.
I wish I saw the play. I'm sure the play was just like amazing.
Yeah, the play was amazing.
It's just a different setting. I mean, it's like just a different, but it's a different way of presenting it.
I have to say though that what we found was when you put a fourth wall in there, and you take it from having to project out to people, to having to draw the audience in with your performance, it changed the intensity and the focus of each of these characters. And it became very, very real. And and we had moments in there that were so intense.
Well, sure.
You know, that you could hear a pin drop because what was being said was the absolute truth from that person's perspective. And none of their perspectives were as you would expect them to be. And I think that right now we have reached a new nexus point in American history where because of social media, the things that black people have been saying were happening for my whole lifetime of the police killing people without cause. Is now has now become a part of a part of the American intellectual property that not only plays here but plays all around the world. And because of that, and because of the establishment's inability to admit or address these public wrongdoings, these are actually public executions, and the establishment's inability to address these public executions has now made the public feel as if there is no law, or as if the law does not apply to everyone. And if there is no law, there can be no order. That's where that saying, no justice, no peace, comes from. No law, no order. And so people are starting to take to mass civil disobedience. Mass civil disobedience can take many forms. It can be peaceful in terms of protest.
Yeah.
It can be violent in terms of shooting at each other.
Yeah.
And so we have, as a culture, we have now armed our country with over 300 million guns. There are more guns than there are people.
Yep.
We have ratcheted up the racial rhetoric. With this presidential campaign, we have not just this campaign, but the Republican establishment who is trying to downplay the racialism of this campaign are the ones who decided at the moment that a black president was elected that they would not do anything to help his presidency, that they would try to make sure before they helped their own constituents that they were going to get him out of office. So now their constituents are enraged, but it's because it's been 8 years of them doing nothing. Their constituents are enraged, but they still have been able to point to Mexicans and Muslims and that black man and say he's the problem, even though they're the ones that have stopped everything that he's tried to do. They're the ones that voted 17 times to vote down a jobs program. They're the ones that said, let's make government smaller and downsize all of those good-paying state government jobs. They are the ones that did all of this. That wasn't Obama's, that wasn't his program.
Right.
And so because of that, we've had an expansion in lower-paying jobs that did not include them.
Yeah.
But if you go back 30 years or a little over 30 years, there was something called trickle-down economics.
Yes, I remember that.
Supply-side economics, Reaganomics, that started the whole thing of freezing wages and sending all of the money to the top, and then it would trickle down to you. They are the ones that voted for that. And so after 30 years of voting in people who sent all the money to the top, then what happened? The SNL scandal happened, and they stole all that money. Then you put in a Democrat, and you said, oh, well, see, look how messed up things are. So then you put back in George Bush. And then what happened? The mortgage scandal happened, and they stole all the money. And now they're ready to do it again as if the last 30 years of supply-side trickle-down economics is not the problem. Instead, it's not that. It's the Mexicans. It's the Muslims. It's the blacks. They're the problems, not the supply side trickle-down economics that we have been supporting for 35 years. And those same people have been stealing from you, and yet they have convinced you that you are one of them. That's what has been going on.
It's funny what you talk about. It must be really interesting because I was born during the civil rights movement, so when I was a kid, when all that stuff was happening in the late 60s, late 70s. So it's kind of, for me, it's interesting if you were an adult or a young person of that era and you're still here today, it must be an interesting outlook to look at that and go, we're fighting for this stuff in the late 60s, early 70s, but now it's kind of rolled back, even though we have more freedoms in some ways, and there we have black billionaires, and we have, you know, we have the middle class, and But then some of the basic things are happening. I have, I was talking to 7 black men. One was my brother and I, were 2 of them. All different ages, all different shades, all different backgrounds. And the sad part was we each had at least, I want to make this clear, at least 2 police stories.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, all different backgrounds, all, you know, from 23 to my age, and anything in between. And we're all, like I said, different shade, from light skin to dark skin to brown. Doctor, lawyer, me, television, my brothers, and packing, shipping and packing. I mean, just like all different stuff. And we had at least 2 stories of police stopping us for some reason.
That's
sad to me. It was very sad to me.
It's sad. And it is part of the evolution of the United States and the evolution of African Americans here. One of the things that is really important here and that we have not addressed yet is the United States Constitution. The Constitution has different articles and amendments. Article 6 in the United States Constitution guarantees that when a person is accused, they are guaranteed the right to a speedy and public trial. So based on the Constitution, the beginning of the accusation is your interaction with the police. The policeman then makes an accusation that you have somehow operated outside of the law. The next step is your arrest.
Yes.
From that arrest, you are then guaranteed a speedy and public trial. When someone is killed during that process, during the process of the accusation, and they are unarmed, and they are not presenting a threat to the policeman, that is a clear violation of Article 6 of the United States Constitution, which guarantees all United States citizens, regardless of race, the right to a speedy and public trial. If you have not been accused, which is what we are seeing on video,
yes,
you have not yet been accused of a crime, then killing a person who has not been accused of a crime is a violation of Article 6 of the United States Constitution. What we have not had yet is for us to, for someone to bring that to the Supreme Court, that is a violation of our constitutional right. It's a constitutional violation to kill an unarmed citizen who is also unaccused. He is not yet accused of a crime, and he is unarmed. It is a violation of the Constitution to kill him. Now, this is of epidemic proportions. It's not just black people.
No, not at all.
It is also white people. Mm-hmm. There have been about 100 people killed since January of 2015, unarmed and unaccused.
That's not good.
So what do we do here? Well, I believe that what needs to happen is immediately upon the constitutional violation by a public servant, that public servant, that policeman, first off, needs to be immediately terminated from the police department. There's no paid leave.
Right.
None of that. He's terminated.
Yeah.
The second thing is that his pension needs to immediately be transferred to the victim's family, so that there is no monetary gain from your inability to distinguish between a life and death situation where your life is threatened and an interaction with a not yet accused and unarmed citizen of the United States. The third thing that needs to happen is that former officer needs to have a permanent mark on his employment record that discludes him from being able to work in law enforcement in any state in the union for the rest of his life in a public service capacity. So if he wants to go into being a private detective, he can still get employment.
Yeah, yeah.
If he wants to work for a security firm, he can still get employment.
Yeah.
What he cannot do is work in a public capacity in a job that says that he has to be responsible for the safety of citizens of the United States when he has killed a citizen of the United States who was not yet accused and was also unarmed. There are hundreds of thousands of police that are working this job. They're working hard. Mm-hmm. It's a hard job.
I have family in law enforcement. Yeah, it's hard.
They're able to do this every day without killing an unarmed citizen who's not accused of a crime. Mm-hmm. If you're not able to do that, you're not of the temperament or judgment to be in a public service capacity in law enforcement. Doesn't mean you're a bad person.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you're not.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean you're a bad person. It means that you are not of the judgment or temperament. You are not inherently qualified for this job. And it often happens that you find out over time that people are not qualified for certain jobs. And those people get fired. And then they go and find another job. And then they go on with their lives.
Yes, true.
If this is a quality that someone has in the police department, that they cannot determine between a life and death situation where their life is in the balance and an interaction between a not yet accused and unarmed citizen, then police work is not the job for them. So they need to be barred from that in every state of the union for the rest of their lives. Then they are free to go on and find what they're good at. What they're not good at is protecting and serving the public. And so that's part of the discussion that we hope that the last revolutionary begins, is what is the solution to this problem? We know the problem is here. And protesting is not solving it. Protesting is just letting the establishment know that we know. What we have to do now is come up with concrete solutions to which we can hold our representatives responsible to implement. And if not, then someone has to explain to us why. Why is it that unarmed and not yet accused citizens of the United States are being executed point blank? And execution is called the death penalty. The death penalty can only be given after a speedy and public trial. If you have denied them a speedy and public trial, then you have denied their constitutional right based on Article 6 of the United States Constitution. And that is the discussion that we need to have. Why is that going on, and what do we need to do to stop it? And that discussion can go all the way to the Supreme Court, because that's the kind of decisions they make.
Where can they find the film? When's it going to come out, do you think?
The film is not out yet, but you can find us on Facebook at The Last Revolutionary Movie. Also on Twitter at The Last Revolutionary Movie. And also on Instagram at The Last Revolutionary Movie.
So keep a lookout for that, because I want to see it. Keep a lookout for that as it comes out.
Yeah,
it's really good.
And also, if you are a social organization or a protest organization and you'd like to have a discussion about moving forward the idea of how do we hold police accountable to our to holding up and recognizing our civil rights based on Article 6 of the Constitution, then that's a discussion that we would be more than happy to have. And whatever we can do to help this move forward, we'd be willing to work with people on.
Very good. I like, seriously, I mean, I have to end the show because I just have to do that, but I could talk to you forever.
Well, we can do it again sometime.
Yes, just
when the movie comes out.
Yes, come back.
I'll come back. We can show some clips. We can talk about it.
I'll have you on my other show called Breaking Into. So it's on this same network.
Okay,
that's what it is. A date. It's a date. I'm pointing off camera to her.
It's a date.
Because I seriously get. I mean, you should. Because I'm a certified life coach. You should be a life coach.
Oh well, thank you very much.
You really give some really great advice that's real and humanistic. That's what I like about it. JJ, thank you so much. It's an honor. It's an honor.
Listen, and for me, thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, you guys, you can follow this. It's going to be on our our Black Hollywood Live channel on YouTube and iTunes. Go ahead and check this out. Download it. Share with everybody, because this is a good discussion. Share with everybody. I'm going to share it too on all my social media platforms, that James Law Jr., of course. And you're on Twitter, too. You're
at Biggie Fries.
Yes.
BiggieFryz.
I love it. So follow him too and comment on what you think of this discussion. Thank you so much for watching us here on Black Hollywood Live. This is Black Hollywood Live's Conversations, and we'll see you next time.
From executives Kevin Undergaro, Dario Kristen, Tiana Hobson, and the entire BHL staff, we would like to thank you for supporting Black Hollywood Live, the first online broadcast network dedicated to African-American entertainment. For questions and comments, contact us. info@blackhollywoodlive.com. Like us on Facebook, tweet us, or Instagram us at BHL Online. And I am the official voice of Black Hollywood Live, Scipio, Instagram at KingXOBay. Thanks for tuning in.
So, well,
the views expressed here are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of BHL or its owners or principals.